Just a quick note before we dive in. This entire episode is AI-generated, including the voices you're hearing. Today's fictional sponsor is ZenFlow Meditation Cushions, designed with memory foam that adapts to your sitting posture. Completely made up, so don't go looking for them online. Some details in our conversation might be inaccurate, so please fact-check anything important to you. I'm Maya, and today I'm talking with David about a book that's been sitting on my shelf for years, haunting me. The Iron Flute, a collection of Zen koans compiled by Nyogen Senzaki in 1989.
It's funny you say haunting, because that's exactly what drew me to it. I'm a cognitive scientist, and these little paradox puzzles shouldn't work the way they do.
Right. And I come at this from the philosophy side, where we're trained to resolve contradictions, not sit with them. But Senzaki was doing something different with these traditional koans.
He was writing for American students in the mid-20th century, taking these ancient Chinese and Japanese riddles and making them, what, accessible? But that word feels wrong.
Accessible is definitely wrong. If anything, he made them more puzzling. The traditional context is gone, so you're left with these bare, impossible statements.
That one about the sound of one hand clapping? In my field, we'd call that a category error. Clapping requires two surfaces. But the koan isn't asking you to solve the logical problem.
It's asking you to break the logical framework entirely. But here's what bothers me. Is that actually philosophy, or is it just mental gymnastics?
That's the question, isn't it? Because something is clearly happening in the mind when you engage with these seriously. There's research on meditation and paradox that suggests...
Wait, hold on. Before we get to the brain scans, I want to push on whether anything meaningful is actually happening at all.
You think it might just be elaborate nonsense?
I think it might be a very sophisticated way of avoiding real questions. Like, instead of grappling with ethics or metaphysics, you just transcend the need for answers.
But that assumes the questions we're avoiding were the right ones to begin with.
Okay, so let's start there. What did Senzaki actually think he was doing? He wasn't just translating ancient text.
No, he was adapting them. He spent decades in American internment camps during World War II, still teaching students who came to him with Western minds.
And Western minds want explanations, cause and effect, logical steps. The whole Enlightenment project.
Right, so he's taking these teaching tools that were designed for a completely different cognitive context and trying to make them work for us.
But what if they can't work for us? What if the cultural gap is too wide?
It's interesting because in my research on cross-cultural cognition, we see that certain mental processes are pretty universal. The capacity for paradox, for instance.
But there's a difference between understanding a paradox and being transformed by one. The koans claim to do the latter.
They do claim that. The Iron Flute talks about sudden enlightenment, these moments where everything shifts. But what's actually shifting?
Let's take a specific one. Do you remember the koan about Joshu's dog? A monk asks if a dog has Buddha nature, and Joshu just says moo. No.
And that's supposedly the whole point, sitting with that moo until something breaks open. But break open into what?
From a philosophical standpoint, it's maddening, because the question is actually meaningful. It's about whether consciousness or spiritual nature is universal.
And in cognitive science, we'd approach that through comparative psychology, studies of animal consciousness, neural complexity.
Exactly. There are real methods for investigating that question, but the koan just refuses to investigate.
Unless the refusal is the investigation. What if the point isn't to answer whether dogs have Buddha nature, but to see how your mind handles the unanswerable?
But why is that valuable? Why is watching your mind spin more useful than actually trying to figure out animal consciousness?
Maybe because the spinning itself is the problem. We get so locked into our analytical frameworks that we miss what's actually happening right in front of us.
That sounds nice in theory, but what does it mean practically? How do you live without analytical frameworks?
Well, you don't throw them away entirely. But maybe you hold them more lightly.
I'm not convinced that's what the koans are teaching. They seem more radical than that. Like they're trying to break something fundamental in how we think.
Breaking might be the wrong metaphor. What if they're trying to show you that thinking was never as solid as you assumed?
Now that's interesting, because if you look at Senzaki's commentary in The Iron Flute, he's not anti-intellectual. He's clearly a sophisticated thinker.
Right, so it's not about becoming stupid. It's about What would you call it?
Maybe it's about recognizing the limits of systematic thinking without abandoning it entirely. But that's a very different claim than sudden enlightenment.
Which brings us back to what's actually happening in people's minds when they work with these. Because there are documented cases of dramatic shifts.
Are there? Or are there documented cases of people believing they've had dramatic shifts?
That's the crucial question, isn't it? How do you verify a transformation in consciousness?
In philosophy, we'd look at whether their reasoning improved, whether they became more clear or consistent in their thinking.
But what if the transformation moves them beyond reasoning entirely? Then our philosophical tests would miss the point.
Or what if there's no transformation at all? Just a very convincing feeling of transformation.
Like a kind of spiritual placebo effect. You engage with these mysterious practices, something feels different. So you assume something profound happened.
Exactly. And the language around koans is perfectly designed to reinforce that. Everything is paradox and mystery, so you can't pin down what actually changed.
But here's where I want to push back on my own field. Just because we can explain something as placebo doesn't mean it's not real or valuable.
How do you mean?
Well, if working with koans makes people more present, more flexible in their thinking, less attached to their mental patterns, those are measurable changes.
But are those changes actually happening? Or is that just the story people tell themselves?
There's some research on long-term meditators that suggests genuine neuroplasticity changes. Less reactivity in the amygdala, more integration between brain regions.
But that's meditation generally, not koans specifically. And brain changes don't necessarily mean wisdom or enlightenment.
Fair point. You could have calm brain patterns and still be completely wrong about everything important.
Right. There are plenty of very Zen people who are terrible at ethics or reasoning. So what exactly is the koan supposed to be cultivating?
Senzaki talks about direct experience as opposed to conceptual understanding, but I've never been clear on what that means.
It's one of those phrases that sounds profound until you try to cash it out. What would direct experience of, say, justice look like?
Or direct experience of suffering versus conceptual understanding of suffering. Is there really a meaningful distinction?
Maybe that's the wrong example. When you're actually in pain, you're not thinking about pain conceptually. You're just in it.
But that's just because pain is immediate and overwhelming. It doesn't make the experience more true or valuable than understanding pain scientifically.
Unless the koans are trying to create that same immediacy for things that are normally abstract, like compassion or wisdom.
How would that work, though? How do you make wisdom immediate?
I don't know. But maybe that's what the paradox is for. To short-circuit the normal conceptual processing and drop you into something else.
Something else being what exactly?
I honestly don't know. And I'm starting to think that not knowing might be the point.
But not knowing what? If I don't know how to fix a car engine, that's just ignorance. What makes not knowing profound?
Maybe it's not knowing after you've exhausted all the ways of knowing. Like, you've thought through every angle and realized thinking itself is insufficient.
Sounds like intellectual defeat, not enlightenment.
Does it? Or does it sound like intellectual honesty?
Okay, let me try a different angle. What if the koans aren't about transcending thinking, but about debugging it?
Debugging how?
Well, most of our mental suffering comes from getting stuck in loops. Rumination, anxiety, rigid beliefs. The koans might be ways of breaking those loops.
By giving your mind something so confusing it has to reset?
By showing you how arbitrary those loops were in the first place, like, you think you need to solve the riddle, but the riddle isn't solvable.
So you learn to be okay with not solving things, but that seems like it could lead to intellectual passivity.
Not necessarily. Maybe you become more selective about what you try to solve, more strategic about where to deploy analytical thinking.
That's actually interesting. Like, some questions benefit from intense analysis, and others just create suffering when you approach them that way.
Right. And the koans might be training wheels for developing that discrimination.
But then, why all the mystical language? Why not just teach good intellectual hygiene directly?
Because intellectual hygiene is still intellectual. You're still operating in the same framework that created the problem.
So you need something that operates outside that framework to show you its boundaries.
Exactly. The koan isn't giving you better concepts. It's showing you where concepts break down.
Okay. But here's what bothers me about that. Concepts break down at the edges, sure, but they're still our best tools for most situations.
Absolutely. But maybe the problem is we've forgotten their tools. We think they're reality itself.
That's a fair point. We do tend to reify our mental categories.
And once you see them as tools, you can pick them up or put them down, depending on what you're trying to accomplish.
Which brings us to something I've been thinking about. What was Senzaki's actual accomplishment with the Iron Flute?
What do you mean?
Well, he took these ancient teaching stories and made them work for 20th century Americans. That's not a small thing.
Oh, it's not. He basically had to reverse engineer the psychological function of the koans and then rebuild them for a different cognitive context.
And the fact that they still feel impossible and paradoxical suggests he succeeded. He preserved whatever was essential.
Which implies there was something essential to preserve. Something that transcends cultural specifics.
Maybe it's just the human tendency to get trapped in mental patterns. That's probably universal.
And the capacity to break free from those patterns, at least temporarily.
But then the question becomes, what do you do with that freedom once you have it?
That's where the koans leave you hanging, isn't it? They're great at breaking down your assumptions, but they don't tell you what to build instead.
Maybe that's intentional. Maybe the point is that you have to figure out what to build, and you can only do that without the old assumptions constraining you.
So, the koan creates a space of possibility, but it doesn't determine what you do with that space.
Which would explain why people can work with the same koan and come to very different insights.
And why the tradition emphasizes working with a teacher. You need someone to help you distinguish between genuine insight and just making stuff up.
But that brings us back to the verification problem. How does the teacher know if your insight is genuine?
In Senzaki's approach, I think it was less about the specific content of the insight and more about whether you could demonstrate genuine freedom from the mental trap.
Freedom meaning what, though? Different behavior? Different emotional responses?
Maybe different relationship to your own thinking. Less identified with your thoughts, more able to hold them lightly.
That sounds testable, actually. You could measure cognitive flexibility, emotional regulation, attachment to beliefs.
You could, but then you're back to measuring the effects rather than the thing itself.
Is there a thing itself beyond the effects?
That might be the ultimate koan question. Is enlightenment a state you achieve, or just a different way of relating to whatever state you're already in?
And if it's the latter, then the whole mystical apparatus becomes unnecessary. You could just relate differently.
But maybe you can't just decide to relate differently. Maybe you need the apparatus to get there.
Like scaffolding that you remove once the building is complete.
Except in this case, the building is invisible, and you're never quite sure if it's actually there.
Which brings me to my final question about the Iron Flute. Was Senzaki really teaching Zen, or was he inventing something new?
What's the difference? If the psychological function is the same, does the historical lineage matter?
It matters if you think wisdom traditions accumulate actual knowledge over time. If he was innovating, then maybe he lost something important from the original.
Maybe he found something the original missed. The koans evolved when they moved from China to Japan, too.
True. But there's something unsettling about not being able to verify whether the evolution represents progress or decay.
Unless that uncertainty is exactly what the koans are designed to cultivate. Comfort with not knowing.
So we're back where we started. Sitting with questions that can't be definitively answered.
Maybe that's the real test. Can you investigate something deeply without needing to resolve it completely?
I'm not sure I can. My philosophical training rebels against that kind of intellectual surrender.
And my scientific training wants measurable outcomes. But maybe that's exactly what we need to transcend.
Or maybe that's what we need to preserve. The question is whether the Iron Flute offers genuine wisdom or just a very sophisticated way of avoiding hard questions.
And we may never know for sure, which is either the most frustrating thing about koans or the most beautiful.
I'm going to go with frustrating for now, but ask me again in 20 years of sitting with these impossible little riddles.